feeling brain all the time, and he got paid copious amounts of money to be drunk on daytime talk shows. So there's that. Here's the truth. The feeling brain is driving our consciousness car. And I don't care how scientific you think you are or how many letters you have after your name, you're one of us, bucko. You're a crazy feeling brain piloted meat robot just like the rest of us. Keep your bodily fluids to yourself, please. The feeling brain drives our consciousness car because ultimately, we are moved to action only by emotion. That's because action is emotion. Emotion is the biological hydraulic system that pushes our bodies into movement. Fear is not this magical thing your brain invents. No, it happens in our bodies. It's the tightening of your stomach, the tensing of your muscles, the release of adrenaline, the overwhelming desire for space and emptiness around your body. While the thinking brain exists solely within the synaptic arrangements inside your skull, the feeling brain is the wisdom and stupidity of the entire body. Anger pushes your body to move. Anxiety pulls it into retreat. Joy lights up the facial muscles, while sadness attempts to shade your existence from view. Emotion inspires action, and action inspires emotion. The two are inseparable. This leads to the simplest and most obvious answer to the timeless question. Why don't we do things we know we should do? Because we don't feel like it. Every problem of self-control is not a problem of information or discipline or reason, but rather of emotion. Self-control is an emotional problem. Laziness is an emotional problem. Procrastination is an emotional problem. Underachievement is an emotional problem. Impulsiveness is an emotional problem. This sucks, because emotional problems are much harder to deal with than logical ones. There are equations to help you calculate the monthly payments on your car loan. There are no equations to help you end a bad relationship. And as you've probably figured out by now, intellectually understanding how to change your behavior doesn't change your behavior. Trust me, I've read like 12 books on nutrition, and I'm still chomping on a bacon cheeseburger as I write this. We know we should stop smoking cigarettes, or stop eating sugar, or stop talking shit about our friends behind their backs. But we still do it. And it's not because we don't know better. It's because we don't feel better. Emotional problems are irrational, meaning they cannot be reasoned with. And this brings us to even worse news. Emotional problems can only have emotional solutions. It's all up to the feeling brain. And if you've seen how most people's feeling brains drive, that's pretty fucking scary. Meanwhile, while all of this is going on, the thinking brain is sitting in the passenger seat, imagining itself to be totally in control of the situation. If the feeling brain is our driver, then the thinking brain is the navigator. It has stacks of maps to reality that it has drawn and accumulated throughout life. It knows how to double back and find alternate routes to the same destination. It knows where the bad turns are and where to find the shortcuts. It correctly sees itself as the intelligent, rational brain, and it believes that this somehow privileges it to be in control of the consciousness car. But, alas, it doesn't. As Daniel Kahneman once put it, the thinking brain is the supporting character who imagines herself to be the hero. Even if sometimes they can't stand each other, our two brains need each other. The feeling brain generates the emotions that cause us to move into action, and the thinking brain suggests where to direct that action. The key word here is suggests. While the thinking brain is not able to control the feeling brain, it is able to influence it, sometimes to a great degree. The thinking brain can convince the feeling brain to pursue a new road to a better future, to pull a U-turn when it has made a mistake, or to consider new routes or territories once ignored. But the feeling brain is stubborn, and if it wants to go in one direction, it will drive that way no matter how many facts or data the thinking brain provides. Moral psychologist Jonathan Haidt compares the two brains to an elephant and its rider. The rider can gently steer and pull the elephant in a particular direction, but ultimately, the elephant's going to go where it wants to go. The clown car. The feeling brain, as great as it is, has its dark side. In the consciousness car, your feeling brain is like a verbally abusive boyfriend who refuses to pull over and ask for directions. He hates being told where to go, and he will absolutely make you fucking miserable if you question his driving. In order to avoid these psychological kerfuffles and to maintain a sense of hope, the thinking brain develops a tendency to draw maps explaining or justifying where the feeling brain has already decided it wants to go. If the feeling brain wants ice cream, instead of contradicting it with facts about processed sugar and excess calories, your thinking brain decides, you know what? I worked hard today. I deserve some ice cream. And your feeling brain responds with a sense of ease and satisfaction. If your feeling brain decides that your partner is an asshole and you've done nothing wrong, your thinking brain's immediate reaction will be to recall instances when you, in fact, were a beacon of patience and humility while your partner was secretly conspiring to ruin your life. In this way, the two brains develop a really unhealthy relationship that might resemble your mom and dad on road trips when you were a kid. The thinking brain makes shit up that the feeling brain wants to hear, and in return, the feeling brain promises not to careen off the side of the road, killing everyone. It's incredibly easy to let your thinking brain fall into the trap of merely drawing the maps the feeling brain wants to follow. This is called the self-serving bias, and it's the basis for pretty much everything awful about humanity. Usually, the self-serving bias simply makes you prejudiced and a little bit self-centered. You assume that what feels right is right. You make snap judgments about people, places, groups, and ideas, many of which are unfair or even a little bit bigoted. But in its extreme form, the self-serving bias can become outright delusion, causing you to believe in a reality that is not there, smudging memories and exaggerating facts, all in the service of the feeling brain's never-ending cravings. If the thinking brain is weak and or uneducated, or if the feeling brain is riled up, the thinking brain will succumb to the feeling brain's fiery whims and dangerous driving. It will lose the ability to think for itself or to contradict the feeling brain's conclusions. This effectively turns your consciousness car into a clown car, with big springy red wheels and a circus theme playing over a loudspeaker wherever you go. Your consciousness car becomes a clown car when your thinking brain has completely capitulated to your feeling brain, when your life's pursuits are determined purely by self-gratification, when truth warps into a cartoon of self-serving assumptions, when all beliefs and principles are lost in a sea of nihilism. The clown car invariably drives toward addiction, narcissism, and compulsion. People whose minds are clown cars are easily manipulated by whatever person or group makes them feel good consistently, whether it's a religious leader, politician, self-help guru, or sinister internet forum. A clown car will gladly steamroll other consciousness cars, i.e. other people, with its big red rubbery tires because its thinking brain will justify this by saying they deserved it. They were evil, inferior, or part of some made-up problem. Some clown cars merely drive toward fun. They're all about drinking and fucking and partying. Others drive toward power. These are the most dangerous clown cars, as their thinking brains set to work justifying their abuse and subjugation of others through intellectual-sounding theories about economics, politics, race, genetics, gender, biology, history, and so on. A clown car will sometimes pursue hate, too, because hate brings its own odd satisfaction and self-assurance. Such a mind is prone to self-righteous anger, as having an external target reassures it of its own moral superiority. Inevitably, it drives towards the destruction of others, because it is only through the destruction and subjugation of the outer world that its endless inner impulses can be satisfied. It's hard to pull someone out of the clown car once they're in it. In the clown car, the thinking brain has been bullied and abused by the feeling brain for so long that it develops a sort of Stockholm syndrome. It can't imagine a life beyond pleasing and justifying the feeling brain. It can't fathom contradicting the feeling brain or challenging it on where it's going, and it resents you for suggesting that it should. With the clown car, there's no independent thought and no ability to measure contradiction or switch beliefs or opinions. In a sense, the person with a clown car mind ceases to have an individual identity at all. This is why cultish leaders always start by encouraging people to shut off their thinking brains as much as possible. Initially, this feels profound to people, because the thinking brain is often correcting the feeling brain, showing it where it took a wrong turn. So silencing the thinking brain will feel extremely good for a short period, and people are always mistaking what feels good for what is good. The clown car is what inspired ancient philosophers to warn against the overindulgence and worship of feelings. It was the fear of the clown car that inspired the Greeks and Romans to teach of the virtues, and later, the Christian church to push a message of abstinence and self-denial. Both classical philosophers and the church had seen the destruction wrought by narcissistic and megalomaniacal men in power, and they all believed that the only way to manage the feeling brain was to deprive it, to give it as little oxygen as possible, thus preventing it from exploding and destroying the world around it. This thinking gave birth to the classic assumption that the only way to be a good person is through dominance of the thinking brain over the feeling brain, the championing of reason over emotion, duty over desire. For most of human history, people have been brutal, superstitious, and uneducated. People in the Middle Ages used to torture cats for sport and take their kids to watch the local burglar get his nuts chopped off in the town square. People were sadistic, impulsive fuckers. For most of history, the world has not been a pleasant place to live, and that was largely because everyone's feeling brains were running amok. The classic assumption was often the only thing that stood between civilization and total anarchy. Then something happened in the last couple of hundred years. People built trains and cars and invented central heating and stuff. Economic prosperity outran human impulses. People were no longer worried about not being able to eat, or about being killed for insulting the king. Life was more comfortable and easier. People now had a ton of free time to sit and think and worry about all sorts of existential shit that they had never considered before. As a result, several movements arose in the late 20th century championing the feeling brain. And indeed, liberating the feeling brain from the thinking brain's suppression was incredibly therapeutic for millions of people, and continues to be so today. The problem was that people began to go too far the other way. They went from recognizing and honoring their feelings to the other extreme of believing that their feelings were the only thing that mattered. This has been particularly true for white middle-class yuppies who were raised under the classic assumption, grew up miserable, and then got in touch with their feeling brains at a much later age. Because these people never had any real problems in their lives other than feeling bad, they erroneously came to believe that feelings were all that mattered, and that the thinking brain's maps were merely inconvenient distractions from those feelings. Many of these people called this shutting off of their thinking brains in favor of their feeling brains spiritual growth, and convinced themselves that being self-absorbed twats brought them closer to enlightenment, when really, they were just indulging the old feeling brain. It was the same old clown car, with a new spiritual-looking paint job. The overindulgence of emotion leads to a crisis of hope, but so does the repression of emotion. The person who denies his feeling brain numbs himself to the world around him. By rejecting his emotions, he rejects making value judgments, that is, deciding that one thing is better than another. As a result, he becomes indifferent to life and the results of his decisions. He struggles to engage with others, his relationships suffer, and eventually, his chronic indifference leads him to an unpleasant visit with the uncomfortable truth. After all, if nothing is more or less important, then there's no reason to do anything. And if there's no reason to do anything, then why live at all? Meanwhile, the person who denies his thinking brain becomes impulsive and selfish, warping reality to conform to his whims and fancies, which are then never satiated. His crisis of hope is that no matter how much he eats, drinks, dominates, or fucks, it will never be enough. It will never matter enough. It will never feel significant enough. He will be on a perpetual treadmill of desperation, always running, though never moving. And if at any point he stops, the uncomfortable truth immediately catches up to him. I know, I'm being dramatic again. But I have to be thinking brain. Otherwise, the feeling brain will get bored and stop the book. Ever wonder why a page turner is a page turner? It's not you turning those pages, idiot. It's your feeling brain. It's the anticipation and suspense, the joy of discovery and the satisfaction of resolution. Good writing is writing that is able to speak to and stimulate both brains at the same time. And this is the whole problem, speaking to both brains, integrating our brains into a cooperative, coordinated, unified whole. Because if self-control is an illusion of the thinking brain's overblown self-regard, then it's self-acceptance that will save us, accepting our emotions and working with them rather than against them. But to develop that self-acceptance, we have to do some work, thinking brain. Let's talk. Meet me in the next section.
An open letter to your thinking brain. Hey, thinking brain. How are things? How's the family? How'd that tax situation work out? Oh, wait, never mind. I forgot. I don't fucking care. Look, I know there's something the feeling brain is screwing up for you. Maybe it's an important relationship. Maybe it's causing you to make embarrassing phone calls at 3 a.m. Maybe it's constantly medicating itself with substances it probably shouldn't be using. I know there's something you wish you could control about yourself, but can't. And I imagine, at times, this problem causes you to lose hope. But listen, thinking brain, those things you hate so much about your feeling brain, the cravings, the impulses, the horrible decision-making, you need to find a way to empathize with them. Because that's the only language the feeling brain really understands. Empathy. The feeling brain is a sensitive creature. It's made out of your damn feelings, after all. I wish it weren't true. I wish you could just show it a spreadsheet to make it understand. You know, like we understand. But you can't. Instead of bombarding the feeling brain with facts and reason, start by asking how it's feeling. Say something like, hey, feeling brain, how do you feel about going to the gym today? Or, how do you feel about changing careers? Or, how do you feel about selling everything and moving to Tahiti? The feeling brain won't respond with words. No, the feeling brain is too quick for words. Instead, it will respond with feelings. Yeah, I know that's obvious, but sometimes you're kind of a dumbass, thinking brain. The feeling brain might respond with a feeling of laziness or a feeling of anxiety. There might even be multiple emotions. A little bit of excitement with a pinch of anger thrown into the mix. Whatever it is, you, as the thinking brain, aka the responsible one in this cranium, need to remain non-judgmental in the face of whatever feelings arise. Feeling lazy? That's okay. We all feel lazy sometimes. Feeling self-loathing? Perhaps that's an invitation to take the conversation further. The gym can wait. It's important to let the feeling brain air out all its icky, twisted feelings. Just get them out into the open, where they can breathe. Because the more they breathe, the weaker their grip is on the steering wheel of your consciousness car. Then, once you feel you've reached a point of understanding with your feeling brain, it's time to appeal to it in a way it understands. Through feelings. Maybe think about all the benefits of some desired new behavior. Maybe mention all the sexy, shiny, fun things at the desired destination. Maybe remind the feeling brain how good it feels to have exercised, how great it will feel to look good in a bathing suit this summer, how much you respect yourself when you followed through on your goals, how happy you are when you live by your values, when you act as an example to the ones you love. Basically, you need to bargain with your feeling brain the way you'd bargain with a Moroccan rug seller. It needs to believe it's getting a good deal, or else it'll just be a lot of hand-waving and shouting with no result. Maybe you agree to do something the feeling brain likes, as long as it does something it doesn't like. Watch your favorite TV show, but only at the gym while you're on the treadmill. Go out with friends, but only if you've paid your bills for the month. Start easy. Remember, the feeling brain is highly sensitive and completely unreasonable. When you offer something easy with an emotional benefit, for example, feeling good after a workout, pursuing a career that feels significant, being admired and respected by your kids, the feeling brain will respond with another emotion, either positive or negative. If the emotion is positive, the feeling brain will be willing to drive a little bit in that direction, but only a little bit. Remember, feelings never last. That's why you start small. Just put on your gym shoes today, feeling brain. That's all. Let's just see what happens. If the feeling brain's response is negative, you simply acknowledge that negative emotion and offer another compromise. See how the feeling brain responds, then rinse and repeat. But whatever you do, do not fight the feeling brain. That just makes it worse. For one, you won't win, ever. The feeling brain is always driving. Second, fighting with the feeling brain about feeling bad will only cause the feeling brain to feel even worse. So why would you do that? You were supposed to be the smart one, thinking brain. This dialogue with your feeling brain will continue back and forth like this, on and off, for days, weeks, or maybe even months. Hell, years. This dialogue between the brains takes practice. For some, the practice will be recognizing what emotion the feeling brain is putting out there. Some people's thinking brains have ignored their feeling brains for so long that it takes them a while to learn how to listen again. Others will have the opposite problem. They will have to train their thinking brain to speak up, force it to propose an independent thought, a new direction, that's separate from the feeling brain's feelings. They will have to ask themselves, what if my feeling brain is wrong to feel this way? And then consider the alternatives. This will be difficult for them at first, but the more this dialogue occurs, the more the two brains will begin to listen to each other. The feeling brain will start giving off different emotions, and the thinking brain will have a better understanding of how to help the feeling brain navigate the road of life. This is what's referred to in psychology as emotional regulation, and it's basically learning how to put a bunch of fucking guardrails and one-way signs along your road of life to keep your feeling brain from careening off a cliff. It's hard work, but it's arguably the only work. Because you don't get to control your feelings, thinking brain. Self-control is an illusion. It's an illusion that occurs when both brains are aligned and pursuing the same course of action. It's an illusion designed to give people hope. And when the thinking brain isn't aligned with the feeling brain, people feel powerless, and the world around them begins to feel hopeless. The only way you consistently nail that illusion is by consistently communicating and aligning the brains around the same values. It's a skill, much the same as playing water polo or juggling knives is a skill. It takes work, and there will be failures along the way. You might slice your arm open and bleed everywhere, but that's just the cost of admission. But here's what you do have, thinking brain. You may not have self-control, but you do have meaning control. This is your superpower. This is your gift. You get to control the meaning of your impulses and feelings. You get to decipher them however you see fit. You get to draw the map. And this is incredibly powerful, because it's the meaning that we ascribe to our feelings that can often alter how the feeling brain reacts to them. And this is how you produce hope. This is how you produce a sense that the future can be fruitful and pleasant, by interpreting the shit the feeling brain slings at you in a profound and useful way. Instead of justifying and enslaving yourself to the impulses, challenge them and analyze them. Change their character and their shape. This is basically what good therapy is, of course. Self-acceptance and emotional intelligence and all that. Actually, this whole teach your thinking brain to decipher and cooperate with your feeling brain instead of judging him and thinking he's an evil piece of shit is the basis for CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, and a lot of other fun acronyms that clinical psychologists invented to make our lives better. Our crises of hope often start with a basic sense that we do not have control over ourselves or our destiny. We feel victims to the world around us, or worse, to our own minds. We fight our feeling brain, trying to beat it into submission. Or we do the opposite and follow it mindlessly. We ridicule ourselves and hide from the world because of the classic assumption, and in many ways, the affluence and connectivity of the modern world only make the pain of the illusion of self-control that much worse. But this is your mission, thinking brain, should you choose to accept it. Engage the feeling brain on its own terms. Create an environment that can bring about the feeling brain's best impulses and intuition, rather than its worst. Accept and work with, rather than against, whatever the feeling brain spews at you. Everything else, all the judgments and assumptions and self-aggrandizement, is an illusion. It was always an illusion. You don't have control, thinking brain. You never did, and you never will. Yet you needn't lose hope. Antonio Damasio ended up writing a celebrated book called Descartes' Error about his experiences with Eliot, the patient whose case I discussed earlier, and much of his other research. In it, he argues that the same way the thinking brain produces a logical, factual form of knowledge, the feeling brain develops its own type of value-laden knowledge. The thinking brain makes associations among facts, data, and observations. Similarly, the feeling brain makes value judgments based on those facts, data, and observations. The feeling brain decides what is good and what is bad, what is desirable and what is undesirable, and most important, what we deserve and what we don't deserve. The thinking brain is objective and factual. The feeling brain is subjective and relative. And no matter what we do, we can never translate one form of knowledge into the other. This is the real problem of hope. It's rare that we don't understand intellectually how to cut back on carbs, or wake up earlier, or stop smoking. It's that somewhere inside our feeling brain, we have decided that we don't deserve to do those things, that we are unworthy of doing them, and that's why we feel so bad about them. This feeling of unworthiness is usually the result of some bad shit happening to us at some point. We suffer through some terrible stuff, and our feeling brain decides that we deserve those bad experiences. Therefore, it sets out, despite the thinking brain's better knowledge, to repeat and re-experience that suffering. This is the fundamental problem of self-control. This is the fundamental problem of hope. Not an uneducated thinking brain, but an uneducated feeling brain. A feeling brain that has adopted and accepted poor value judgments about itself and the world. And this is the real work of anything that even resembles psychological healing, getting our values straight with ourselves so that we can get our values straight with the world. Put another way, the problem isn't that we don't know how not to get punched in the face. The problem is that, at some point, likely a long time ago, we got punched in the face, and instead of punching back, we decided we deserved it. Chapter 3. Newton's Laws of Emotion. The first time Isaac Newton got hit in the face, he was standing in a field. His uncle had been explaining to him why wheat should be planted in diagonal rows, but Isaac wasn't listening. He was gazing into the sun, wondering what the light was made of. He was 7 years old. His uncle backhanded him so hard across his left cheek that Isaac's sense of self temporarily broke upon the ground on which his body fell. He lost any feeling of personal cohesion, and as the parts of his psyche put themselves back together, some secret piece of himself remained in the dirt, left behind in a place from which it would never be recovered. Isaac's father had died before he was born, and his mother soon abandoned her son to marry some old rich guy the next village over. As a result, Isaac spent his formative years being shuffled among uncles, cousins, and grandparents. No one particularly wanted him. Few knew what to do with him. He was a burden. Love came difficultly, and usually not at all. Isaac's uncle was an uneducated drunk, but he did know how to count hedges and rows and fields. It was his one intellectual skill, and because of this, he did it probably more often than he needed to. Isaac often tagged along to these row-counting sessions because it was the only time his uncle ever paid attention to him. And like water in a desert, any attention the boy got, he desperately soaked in. As it turned out, the boy was a kind of prodigy. By age 8, he could project the amount of feed required to sustain the sheep and pigs for the following season. By 9, he could rattle off the top of his head calculations for hectares of wheat, barley, and potatoes. And by age 10, Isaac had decided that farming was stupid and instead turned his attention to calculating the exact trajectory of the sun throughout the seasons. His uncle didn't care about the exact trajectory of the sun because it wouldn't put food on the table, at least not directly. So again, he hit Isaac. School didn't make things any better. Isaac was pale and scrawny and absent-minded. He lacked social skills. He was into nerdy shit like sundials, Cartesian planes, and determining whether the moon was actually a sphere. While the other kids played cricket or chased one another through the woods, Isaac stood staring for hours into local streams, wondering how the eyeball was capable of seeing light. Isaac Newton's early life was one slap after another, and after each blow, his feeling brain learned to feel an immutable truth about him, that there must be something inherently wrong with him. Why else would his parents have abandoned him? Why else would his peers ridicule him? What other explanation for his near-constant solitude? While his thinking brain occupied itself drawing fanciful graphs and charting the lunar eclipses, his feeling brain silently internalized the knowledge that there was something fundamentally broken about this small English boy from Lincolnshire. One day, he wrote in his school notebook, "I am a little fellow, pale and weak. There is no room for me, not in the house or in the bottom of hell. What can I do? What am I good for? I cannot but weep." Up until this point, everything you've read about Newton is true, or at least highly realistic. But let's pretend for a moment that there's a parallel universe. And let's say that in this parallel universe, there's another Isaac Newton, much like our own. He still comes from a broken and abusive family. He still lives a life of angry isolation. He still prodigiously measures and calculates everything he encounters. But let's say that instead of obsessively measuring and calculating the external natural world, this parallel universe Newton decides to obsessively measure and calculate the internal psychological world, the world of the human mind and heart. This isn't a huge leap of the imagination, as the victims of abuse are often the keenest observers of human nature. For you and me, people watching may be something fun to do on a random Sunday in the park. But for the abused, it's a survival skill. For them, violence might erupt at any moment. Therefore, they develop a keen, spidey sense to protect themselves. A lilt in someone's voice, the rise of an eyebrow, the depth of a sigh. Anything can set off their internal alarm. So, this parallel universe Newton, this emo Newton, turned his obsession toward the people around him. He kept notebooks, cataloging all the observable behaviors of his peers and family. He scribbled relentlessly, documenting every action, every word. He filled hundreds of pages with inane observations of the kind of stuff people don't even realize they do. Emo Newton hoped that if measurement could be used to predict and control the natural world, the shapes and configurations of the sun and moon and stars, then it should also be able to predict and control the internal, emotional world. And through his observations, Emo Newton realized something painful that we all kind of know, but that few of us ever want to admit. That people are liars, all of us. We lie constantly and habitually. We lie about important things and trifling things. And we usually don't lie out of malice. Rather, we lie to others because we're in such a habit of lying to ourselves. Isaac noted that light refracted through people's hearts in ways that they themselves did not seem to see, that people said they loved those whom they appeared to hate, professed to believe one thing while doing another, imagined themselves righteous while committing acts of the grandest dishonesty and cruelty. Yet in their own minds, they somehow believed their actions to be consistent and true. Isaac decided that no one could be trusted, ever. He calculated that his pain was inversely proportional to the distance squared he put between himself and the world. Therefore, he kept to himself, staying in no one's orbit, spinning out and away from the gravitational tug of any other human heart. He had no friends, nor, he decided, did he want any. He concluded that the world was a bleak, wretched place, and that the only value to his pathetic life was his ability to document and calculate that wretchedness. For all his surliness, Isaac certainly didn't lack ambition. He wanted to know the trajectory of men's hearts, the velocity of their pain. He wished to know the force of their values and the mass of their hopes. And most important, he wanted to understand the relationships among all these elements. He decided to write Newton's Three Laws of Emotion. Newton's First Law of Emotion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite emotional reaction. Imagine that I punch you in the face. No reason, no justification, just pure violence. Your instinctual reaction might be to retaliate in some way. Maybe it'd be physical. You'd punch me back. Maybe it'd be verbal. You'd call me a bunch of four-letter words. Or maybe your retaliation would be social. You'd call the police or some other authority and have me punished for assaulting you. Regardless of your response, you would feel a rush of negative emotion directed toward me. And rightly so. Clearly, I'm an awful person. After all, the idea that I get to cause you pain with no justification, without your deserving pain, generates a sense of injustice between us. A kind of moral gap opens between us. The sense that one of us is inherently righteous and the other is an inferior piece of shit. Pain causes moral gaps, and it's not just between people. If a dog bites you, your instinct is to punish it. If you stub your toe on a coffee table, what do? You yell at the damn coffee table. If your home is washed away in a flood, you are overcome with grief and become furious at God, the universe, life itself. These are moral gaps. They are a sense that something wrong has just happened, and you, or someone else, deserve to be made whole again. Wherever there is pain, there is always an inherent sense of superiority or inferiority, and there's always pain. When confronted with moral gaps, we develop overwhelming emotions towards equalization, or a return to moral equality. These desires for equalization take the form of a sense of deserving. Because I punched you, you feel I deserve to be punched back, or punished in some way. This feeling of my deserving pain will cause you to have strong emotions about me, most likely anger. You will also have strong emotions around the feeling that you didn't deserve to be punched, that you did no wrong, and that you deserve better treatment from me and everyone else around you. These feelings might take the form of sadness, self-pity, or confusion. This whole sense of deserving something is a value judgment we make in the face of a moral gap. We decide that something is better than something else, that one person is more righteous or just than another, that one event is less desirable than another. Moral gaps are where our values are born. Now, let's pretend I apologize to you for punching you. I say, "Hey, reader, that was totally unfair, and wow, I was way out of line. That will never, ever happen again, and as a symbol of my overwhelming regret and guilt, here, I baked you a cake. Oh, and here's $100. Enjoy." Let's also pretend that this is somehow satisfying to you. You accept my apology and my cake and the $100 and genuinely feel that everything is fine. We've now equalized. The moral gap that was between us is gone. I've made up for it. You might even say we're even. Neither of us is a better or worse person than the other. Neither of us deserves better or worse treatment than the other any longer. We're operating on the same moral plane. Equalizing like this restores hope. It means that there's nothing necessarily wrong with you or wrong with the world. That you can go about your day with a sense of self-control, $100, and a sweet-ass cake. Now let's imagine another scenario. This time, instead of punching you, let's say I buy you a house. Yes, reader, I just bought you a fucking house. This will open up another moral gap between us. But instead of an overwhelming feeling of wanting to equalize the pain I've caused you, you will instead experience an overwhelming feeling of wanting to equalize the joy I've created. You might hug me, say thank you 100 times, give me a gift in return, or promise to babysit my cat from now until eternity. Or if you're particularly well-mannered and have some self-control, you may even attempt to refuse my offer to buy you a house because you recognize that it will open up a moral gap that you will never be able to surmount. You may acknowledge this by saying to me, "Thank you, but absolutely not. There's no way for me ever to repay you." As with the negative moral gap, with the positive moral gap, you will feel indebted to me, that you owe me something, that I deserve something good, or that you need to make it up to me somehow. You will have intense feelings of gratitude and appreciation in my presence. You might even shed a tear of joy. Aw, reader. It's our natural psychological inclination to equalize across moral gaps, to reciprocate actions, positive for positive, negative for negative. The forces that impel us to fill those gaps are our emotions. In this sense, every action demands an equal and opposite emotional reaction. This is Newton's first law of emotion. Newton's first law is constantly dictating the flow of our lives because it is the algorithm by which our feeling brain interprets the world. If a movie causes more pain than it relieves, you become bored, or perhaps even angry. Maybe you even attempt to equalize by demanding your money back. If your mother forgets your birthday, maybe you equalize by ignoring her for the next 6 months. Or, if you're more mature, you communicate your disappointment to her. If your favorite sports team loses in a horrible way, you will feel compelled to attend fewer games or to cheer for them less. If you discover you have a talent for drawing, the admiration and satisfaction you derive from your competence will inspire you to invest time, energy, emotion, and money into the craft. If your country elects a bozo whom you can't stand, you will feel a disconnect with your nation and government and even other citizens. You will also feel as though you are owed something in return for putting up with terrible policies. Equalization is present in every experience because the drive to equalize is emotion itself. Sadness is a feeling of powerlessness to make up for a perceived loss. Anger is the desire to equalize through force and aggression. Happiness is feeling liberated from pain, while guilt is the feeling that you deserve some pain that never arrived. This desire for equalization underlies our sense of justice. It's been codified throughout the ages into rules and laws, such as the Babylonian king Hammurabi's classic, "An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth," or the biblical golden rule, "Do unto others what you would have done unto you." In evolutionary biology, it's known as reciprocal altruism, and in game theory, it's called a tit-for-tat strategy. Newton's first law generates our sense of morality. It underlies our perceptions of fairness. It is the bedrock of every human culture, and it is the operating system of the feeling brain. While our thinking brain creates factual knowledge around observation and logic, the feeling brain creates our values around our experiences of pain. Experiences that cause us pain create a moral gap within our minds, and our feeling brain deems those experiences inferior and undesirable. Experiences that relieve pain create a moral gap in the opposite direction, and our feeling brain deems those experiences superior and desirable. One way to think about it is that the thinking brain makes lateral connections between events, sameness, contrast, cause and effect, etc., while the feeling brain makes hierarchical connections, better and worse, more desirable, less desirable, morally superior versus morally inferior. Our thinking brain thinks horizontally, how are these things related, while our feeling brain thinks vertically, which of these things is better or worse. Our thinking brain decides how things are, and our feeling brain decides how things ought to be. When we have experiences, our feeling brain creates a sort of value hierarchy for them. It's as though we have a massive bookshelf in our subconscious where the best and most important experiences in life, with family, friends, burritos, are on the top shelf, and the least desirable experiences, death, taxes, indigestion, are on the bottom. Our feeling brain then makes its decisions by simply pursuing experiences on the highest shelf possible. Both brains have access to the value hierarchy. While the feeling brain determines what shelf something is on, the thinking brain is able to point out how certain experiences are connected and to suggest how the value hierarchy should be reorganized. This is essentially what growth is, reprioritizing one's value hierarchy in an optimal way. For example, I once had a friend who was probably the hardest partier I'd ever known. She would stay out all night and then go straight to work from the party in the morning, with 0 hours of sleep. She thought it lame to wake up early or stay home on a Friday night. Her value hierarchy went something like this. First, really awesome DJs, then really good drugs, then work, then sleep. One could predict her behavior solely from this hierarchy. She'd rather work than sleep. She'd rather party and get fucked up than work. And everything was about the music. Then she did one of those volunteer abroad things, where young people spend a couple months working with orphans in a third world country, and, well, that changed everything. The experience was so emotionally powerful that it completely rearranged her value hierarchy. Her hierarchy now looks something like this: saving children from unnecessary suffering, then work, then sleep, then parties. And suddenly, as if by magic, the parties stopped being fun. Why? Because they interfered with her new top value, helping suffering kids. She switched careers and was all about work now. She stayed in most nights. She didn't drink or do drugs. She slept well. After all, she needed tons of energy to save the world. Her party friends looked at her and pitied her. They judged her by their values, which were her old values. Poor party girl has to go to bed and get up for work every morning. Poor party girl can't stay out doing MDMA every weekend. But here's the funny thing about value hierarchies. When they change, you don't actually lose anything. It's not that my friend decided to start giving up the parties for her career. It's that the parties stopped being fun. That's because fun is the product of our value hierarchies. When we stop valuing something, it ceases to be fun or interesting to us. Therefore, there is no sense of loss, no sense of missing out when we stop doing it. On the contrary, we look back and wonder how we ever spent so much time caring about such a silly, trivial thing, why we wasted so much energy on issues and causes that didn't matter. These pangs of regret or embarrassment are good. They signify growth. They are the product of achieving our hopes. Newton's second law of emotion. Our self-worth equals the sum of our emotions over time. Let's return to the punching example, except this time, let's pretend I exist within this magical force field that prevents any consequences from ever befalling me. You can't punch me back. You can't say anything to me. You can't even say anything to anyone else about me. I'm impervious, an all-seeing, all-powerful, evil ass face. Newton's first law of emotion states that when someone or something causes us pain, a moral gap opens up, and our feeling brain summons up icky emotions to motivate us to equalize. But what if that equalization never comes? What if someone or something makes us feel awful, yet we are incapable of ever retaliating or reconciling? What if we feel powerless to do anything to equalize or make things right? What if my force field is just too powerful for you? When moral gaps persist for a long enough time, they normalize. They become our default expectation. They lodge themselves into our value hierarchy. If someone hits us and we're never able to hit them back, eventually our feeling brain will come to a startling conclusion. We deserve to be hit. After all, if we didn't deserve it, we would have been able to equalize, right? The fact that we cannot equalize means that there must be something inherently inferior about us, and/or something inherently superior about the person who hit us. This, too, is part of our hope response, because if equalization seems impossible, our feeling brain comes up with the next best thing: giving in, accepting defeat, judging itself to be inferior and of low value. When someone harms us, our immediate reaction is usually, "He is shit, and I am righteous." But if we're not able to equalize and act on that righteousness, our feeling brain will believe the only alternative explanation: "I am shit, and he is righteous." This surrender to persisting moral gaps is a fundamental part of our feeling brain's nature, and it is Newton's second law of emotion. How we come to value everything in life relative to ourselves is the sum of our emotions over time. This surrender to and acceptance of ourselves as inherently inferior is often referred to as shame or low self-worth. Call it what you want, the result is the same. Life kicks you around a little bit, and you feel powerless to stop it. Therefore, your feeling brain concludes that you must deserve it. Of course, the reverse moral gap must be true as well. If we're given a bunch of stuff without earning it, participation trophies and grade inflation, gold medals for coming in ninth place, we falsely come to believe ourselves inherently superior to what we actually are. We therefore develop a diluted version of high self-worth, or, as it's more commonly known, being an asshole. Self-worth is contextual. If you were bullied for your geeky glasses and funny nose as a child, your feeling brain will know that you're a dweeb, even if you grow up to be a flaming sex pot of hotness. People who are raised in strict religious environments and are punished harshly for their sexual impulses often grow up with their feeling brain knowing that sex is wrong, even though their thinking brain has long worked out that sex is natural and totally awesome. High and low self-worth appear different on the surface, but they are two sides of the same counterfeit coin. Because whether you feel as though you're better than the rest of the world or worse than the rest of the world, the same thing is true. You're imagining yourself as something special, something separate from the world. A person who believes he deserves special treatment because of how great he is isn't so different from someone who believes she deserves special treatment because of how shitty she is. Both are narcissistic. Both think they're special. Both think the world should make exceptions and cater to their values and feelings over others. Narcissists will oscillate between feelings of superiority and inferiority. Either everyone loves them or everyone hates them. Everything is amazing or everything is fucked. An event was either the best moment of their lives or traumatizing. With the narcissist, there's no in-between. Because to recognize the nuanced, indecipherable reality before him would require that he relinquish his privileged view that he is somehow special. Mostly, narcissists are unbearable to be around. They make everything about them and demand that people around them do the same. You'll see this high-low self-worth switcheroo everywhere if you keep an eye out for it. Mass murderers, dictators, whiny kids, your obnoxious aunt who ruins Christmas every year. Hitler preached that the world treated Germany so poorly after World War I only because they were afraid of German superiority. And in California more recently, a disturbed gunman justified trying to shoot up a sorority house with the fact that while women hooked up with inferior men, he was forced to remain a virgin. You can even find it within yourself if you're being honest. The more insecure you are about something, the more you'll fly back and forth between delusional feelings of superiority, I'm the best, and delusional feelings of inferiority, I'm garbage. Self-worth is an illusion. It's a psychological construct that our feeling brain spins up in order to predict what will help it and what will hurt it. Ultimately, we must feel something about ourselves in order to feel something about the world, and without those feelings, it's impossible for us to find hope. We all possess some degree of narcissism. It's inevitable, as everything we ever know or experience has happened to us or been learned by us. The nature of our consciousness dictates that everything happened through us. It is only natural, then, that our immediate assumption is that we are at the center of everything, because we are at the center of everything we experience. We all overestimate our skills and intentions and underestimate the skills and intentions of others. Most people believe that they are of above-average intelligence and have an above-average ability at most things, especially when they are not and do not. We all tend to believe that we're more honest and ethical than we actually are. We will each, given the chance, delude ourselves into believing what's good for us is also good for everyone else. When we screw up, we tend to assume it was some happy accident. But when someone else screws up, we immediately rush to judge that person's character. Persistent low-level narcissism is natural, but it's also likely at the root of many of our socio-political problems. This is not a right-wing or left-wing problem. This is not an older generation or younger generation problem. This is not an Eastern or Western problem. This is a human problem. Every institution will decay and corrupt itself. Each person, given more power and fewer restraints, will predictably bend that power to suit himself. Every individual will blind herself to her own flaws while seeking out the glaring flaws of others. Welcome to Earth. Enjoy your stay. Our feeling brains warp reality in such a way that we believe that our problems and pain are somehow special and unique in the world, despite all evidence to the contrary. Human beings require this level of built-in narcissism because narcissism is our last line of defense against the uncomfortable truth. Because let's be real, people suck, and life is exceedingly difficult and unpredictable. Most of us are winging it as we go, if not completely lost. And if we didn't have some false belief in our own superiority, or inferiority, a deluded belief that we're extraordinary at something, we'd line up to swan dive off the nearest bridge. Without a little bit of that narcissistic delusion, without that perpetual lie we tell ourselves about our specialness, we'd likely give up hope. But our inherent narcissism comes at a cost. Whether you believe you're the best in the world or the worst in the world, one thing is also true. You are separate from the world. And it's this separateness that ultimately perpetuates unnecessary suffering. Newton's third law of emotion. Your identity will stay your identity until a new experience acts against it. Here's a common sob story. Boy cheats on girl. Girl's heartbroken. Girl despairs. Boy leaves girl, and girl's pain lingers for years afterward. Girl feels like shit about herself. And in order for her feeling brain to maintain hope, her thinking brain must pick one of two explanations. She can either believe that A, all boys are shit, or B, she is shit. Well, shit. Neither of those is a good option. But she decides to go with option A, all boys are shit, because, after all, she still has to live with herself. This choice isn't made consciously, mind you. It just kind of happens. Jump ahead a few years. Girl meets another boy. This boy isn't shit. In fact, this boy is the opposite of shit. He's pretty rad, and sweet, and cares. Like, really, truly cares. But girl is in a conundrum. How can this boy be real? How can he be true? After all, she knows that all boys are shit. It's true. It must be true. She has the emotional scars to prove it. Sadly, the realization that this boy is not shit is too painful for girl's feeling brain to handle. So she convinces herself that he is, indeed, shit. She nitpicks his tiniest flaws. She notices every errant word, every misplaced gesture, every awkward touch. She zeroes in on his most insignificant mistakes until they stand bright in her mind like a flashing strobe light screaming, "Run away! Save yourself!" So she does. She runs, and she runs in the most horrible of ways. She leaves him for another boy. After all boys are shit. So what's trading one piece of shit for another? It means nothing. Boy is heartbroken. Boy despairs. The pain lingers for years and morphs into shame. And this shame puts the boy in a tough position. Because now his thinking brain must make a choice. Either A, all girls are shit, or B, he is shit. Our values aren't just collections of feelings. Our values are stories. When our feeling brain feels something, our thinking brain sets to work constructing a narrative to explain that something. Losing your job doesn't just suck. You've constructed an entire narrative around it. Your asshole boss wronged you after years of loyalty. You gave yourself to that company. And what did you get in return? Our narratives are sticky, clinging to our minds and hanging onto our identities like tight, wet clothes. We carry them around with us and define ourselves by them. We trade narratives with others, looking for people whose narratives match our own. We call these people friends, allies, good people. And those who carry narratives that contradict our own, we call them evil. Our narratives about ourselves and the world are fundamentally about A, something or someone's value, and B, whether that something or someone deserves that value. All narratives are constructed in this way. Bad thing happens to person or thing, and he, she, it doesn't deserve it. Good thing happens to person or thing, and he, she, it doesn't deserve it. good thing happens to person or thing, and he, she, it deserves it. Bad thing happens to person or thing, and he, she, it deserves it. Every book, myth, fable, history, all human meaning that's communicated and remembered is merely the daisy chaining of these